Ralph Ferris is a violist I met at the Spoleto Festival in Charleston, and we share a lot of memories and musical experiences from our time there and in Spoleto, Italy. We connected on Facebook a few years ago, and I watched his electric string quartet do many amazing things. Ralph is someone who lives and makes music on the edges. The electric string quartet plays rock, jazz, and all styles. He toured with Joe Jackson as the first act and the backup band. Before starting Ethel, he toured with The Who and was the original violist in the Broadway musical The Lion King. But I'll let Ralph tell his story because it's really inspiring. Welcome, music lovers. This is the Cellarondo, a podcast of ideas and stories all about music. My name is Paula Tuttle. I'm a cellist, creator of Chambersight, producer of concerts, and this podcast.
Well, hello, Paula. It is so amazing to speak with you and to hear your voice. It has been ages, and you and I had a fantastic adventure back in, I think it was 1992, when we were both at the Spoleto Festival. We did an all-night drive down to Sarasota, and I just have such a great memory of that time. I don't know what we were thinking. We were both young and crazy.
We were crazy. I remember driving through Savannah and seeing the moss hanging from the trees.
Wasn't that amazing? It was just, you could cut the fog with the knife for sure. This was totally foreign world to me, and such a treat though. And again, what a beautiful memory. So great to reconnect with you.
It's great to connect with you too. And I would follow Ethel on Facebook. That's where we connected just a few years ago. And then I wouldn't see you anymore. I guess you got too famous.
Well, you know what it is? Actually, Ethel's presence, Ethel absolutely has retained its presence on Facebook. And we value the platform as a communication tool, as a community builder. During the pandemic, we built a little group called Ethel and Friends, which has been a wonderful place to share inspirations and works that intrigue and delight, and it's a great place for community building. So the distinction is between Ralph Ferris and, get this, the Ralph Ferris, my professional social media on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. They are the Ralph Ferris. Anyway, so yes.
Well, let's start at the beginning. When did you start Ethel?
We are coming up on our 25th anniversary. We came together in 1998, and the original inspiration was to celebrate community, truly. The composers, the entire art world, really, of our hometown, New York City. And then by extension, to grow across the country and the planet. We felt that there were so many people doing extraordinary work, plenty of quartets just killing it out there. The community of composers and creators and sound designers that were alive and working at that moment in the turn of century New York City, they needed their voices to be heard. They needed to be supported, and they needed to be celebrated. And so that's where we wanted to put our energy, which speaks to why we chose not to call ourselves the Such and Such String Quartet. Because as you know, the second you hear the word, the term string quartet, you get this image of probably tuxedos and a quiet, reverent concert hall situation. And that was just basically the opposite of what we were doing. We were irreverent from the start. We broke down the fourth wall immediately. We were all about welcoming into the conversation for the audience and actually creating a feedback loop, if you will, with the audience, in that, hey, you want to clap during a tune because something is inspiring you, go for it. And that's going to feed us to bring even more to our work as we give it to you. We celebrate the connection with audience and people around us, And that was there from the start. So it was, I suppose, those two things. They were both community oriented, the community of creators and collaborators, and then the community of people with whom we were sharing, because we were first and foremost communicators. We were connectors.
So I heard a quote where someone in the New York Times said, "Don't call it a string quartet, it's a band." You know, so it sounds like you've actually changed the audience.
Yeah, Paula, I think you're really spot on there. Yes. So in doing this work, we found not only as we were coming into our own as real champions of this new scene, that our audience were coming along with us, that they were in fact shifting their perspectives with us. In the very beginning, we had tremendous difficulty figuring out our elevator pitch, if you will. You know, we would always react, well, we're not a string quartet. We're a band, or we're a string group, but I mean, look at us. We are a string quartet. We just happen to play different type music. In resisting that label, there we built a little bit of a defiance in that we're stepping into this new space, a space, in fact, that had been built for us so beautifully by the Kronos Quartet, you know, decade plus before.
Love the Kronos and others Quartet.
Love Kronos. Love them so much, and honor them. So they did work before us to build that world, as had our dear friends Bang on a Can, to shift the audience perspective and expectation. We came in as the sort of young punks and stepped up that work for ourselves and carried on with that conversation of saying to audiences, you are welcome to be you in this space. You are allowed to move, to express. You are welcome to jump up and dance. It took a little while for us to figure, as we were all novices at this when we began. We had been playing concert music our whole lives, all of us, and it was in fact a reaching towards the vernacular and towards the connecting new worlds, the reaffirmation that what's going on in music now is okay, that as we were finding that for ourselves, we were inviting the audiences to that, and they came along. And now it's actually a little bit astonishing what has come in audience response today. We have a beautiful residency at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. It started out at the Balcony Bar, if anyone's familiar with the Met. There's the Great Hall when you walk in, and directly above the Great Hall, there's a big balcony. It goes all the way around the Great Hall. And there was a bar there for many, many years. And they shut that down, obviously, during pandemic. And then we built the Balcony Bar from Home, which was on Facebook, and that was on our site and on the Metropolitan Museum site. Anyone can check in and look at virtual programs that we did weekly for a good year and a half during the pandemic. In the post-pandemic world, we have moved down to the Petrie Court Cafe, which is in the back end of the museum, overlooking Central Park, looking out onto Central Park with the extraordinary Egyptian obelisk. So it's a beautifully inspiring space with big windows and open and bright. And we're down there now playing once or twice a month, or members of us are playing probably 2-3 times a month. My point was that the audiences there, Paula, it is absolutely astonishing. They are jumping up and down, they are clapping, they're hollering, they are, sure, they've got a glass of wine in their hand, but they're up and dancing. We have folks dancing while we're playing. So yes, the audiences have shifted. I think it's no more beautifully illustrated than by the Met audiences, who are truly, I mean, they're just the super fans, super friends. They are very dear to us. They come and plunk right down in the first row. They stay for all 2.5 hours. They know all the repertoire. They get thrilled when new music comes out, and they're with us the whole way. They're not there to be played to. They're there to play with. And I think that is the distinction. And we carry that forward with us to every concert.
It sounds like it was an evolution. You know, the audience changed and you changed. What did you start out expecting that you were going to do with the Ethel String Quartet?
As you know, expectation breeds disappointment. So yes, I was disappointed for a little while. There had been times when we would come to a new space in a new community where they just weren't ready for the more informal presentation and the fourth wall certainly being gone. There were disappointments from time to time. We always gave so much, but every once in a while in the very beginning.
So the audience, it started small and then it grew. How did you find your audience? Was it media or how did you do it?
One of the great things of music today is everyone can find their audience. We have so many beautiful ways of connecting to people through the socials, through all the music platforms. People now are able to find us pretty quickly, and we're able to find them pretty quickly. We find like-minded groups across the world. We collaborate with them. We make friends with them. They make friends with us. We share audiences. Yes, it is always growing. And again, the Met platform is an extraordinary place for that. Through Balcony Bar From Home, we had probably pushing 1.5 million views on that series right now, which is astonishing to me. And then the Petrie Court Cafe now, that place is packed every week when we're there. And people are shooting our shows, you know, they're shooting them, posting them on their own accounts, sharing them with people the world over. So the audience is growing, and I would say, I'm knocking wood right now, exponentially, which is kind of mind-boggling and also really inspiring. We were only ever in it to speak to people and to listen to people, and it seems like that's what's happening right now. Especially as we transition now back into live concert events. People are thirsty for that interpersonal connection. Yes, some are still distancing, some are still masking, that's all fine, support you however you want to go. But the interpersonal, even as we take the baby steps back into it, are so rewarding, and you see the delight in a person's eyes, even behind a mask, when they are able to be with you live and experience a piece of music unfolding with you. So yes, it is growing. It is bringing inspiration to us to step back into it. It is supporting our transition for sure. This love that we get from the audience and we bring back to the audience, it's supporting our transition back into the wonders of touring. And you know that all too well.
So some of our listeners might want to know what the favorites are at your performances, or what are some of the recordings that they could listen to, YouTube or otherwise.
There are a couple favorites that we haven't recorded, and someday we probably will. There are two arrangements, one by our member Kip Jones. It's an arrangement of a tune by a Brooklyn noise pop artist named Dan Friel. The tune is called Valedictorian, and it's kind of astonishing. At its root, it's basically bubblegum pop, and it's just super fun, and everybody's dancing, and we play that all the time at the Met. Always gets people moving. Another favorite, fan favorite, is the music of Philip Glass. We play a suite from The Hours, the film The Hours, and that one always inspires and connects. We have four pieces from that film score that we do, which we love playing. We love bringing the audiences into that space, that we're not just all bombast. We actually have introspection available. We have originals by all of us. We have programs called Documerica and Circus Wandering City. These are both multimedia shows. Circus Wandering City was actually commissioned by the Ringling Museum in Sarasota. Our original music is featured on both of those shows. We have fan favorites from both of those shows. From Documerica, we have music of Ulysses Owens Jr., Revival Crusade is... he's a drummer. extraordinary music educator based in Jacksonville. His music, that particular number, celebrates church traditions from the Deep South. Kip wrote a piece called Shout Out from Documerica, which is a fan favorite. And then from Circus Wandering City, Dorothy, our cellist, Dorothy Lawson, offers A Moment of Truth is a big one. That features Ethel vocals, which is quite exciting. And then Corey Lee wrote a piece called Seat 47C, which is all about the joy of and the wonder of walking into the Big Top. That's also from the Circus show. So Moment of Truth is about the spectacle and the heroism of circus performers. Seat 47C is about the wonder of it. And then I've got a little tune called The Breakaway, which is about the daring aerial events in the circus. And that one's a bit of a crowd pleaser. And then probably one of the biggest hits we have that everyone always wants, called The Suite from the Mission. And it is from The Missions, the film that Ennio Morricone wrote to accompany the film The Mission. It's a overview mashup of the themes of the film to include the super famous and well-loved Gabriel's oboe, which is treated four times in the arrangement, the last two of which feature Kip Jones on vocals. And I gotta tell you, Paula, it's a really weird thing. I've had a couple experiences in my life when I've written something, I arranged this, I didn't write it, but I arranged this, when I put pen to paper one way or the other, and the first time I've rehearsed it or worked it through with a group, I have come to tears. Playing The Mission for the first time, and even to this day, it still makes me cry. It is the most stunningly beautiful melody.
Why don't you tell us the list of the people in the band? I know it's a quartet. Who is the original members and who's in the band now?
We always announce ourselves in alphabetical order, so let me see if I can do this from the air. So I am Ralph Farris. I play viola. Next, we would have Kip Jones, who plays violin. Then Dorothy Lawson, who plays cello. And Corinne Lee, who plays violin. We are all vocalists on top of everything else. We all do sing. We all play percussion. I play bad guitar. Dorothy and I are the founding members of the ensemble. We're the two who have been here for the long haul for 25 years.
You said that your plan was to reach all of the U.S. and then the planet. You must have had a marketing plan, something that had to do with adapting to all the changes that have happened in the music world, you know, from the time, you know, when we were playing in orchestras and opera companies. So let's address that. How have you adapted?
Well, absolutely. And you know, you were there right with me. We came up in the concert music world just at a time when things were really shifting. There was a general rethinking of audience building, of repertoire choice, of even the legitimacy of some ensembles. As orchestras were folding all around us, as chamber groups, legendary chamber groups, were shutting down, as we were losing ground to not only more popular or mainstream expressions of musical, other types of music, and the recording world fell out from under us. So whatever meager profits classical folks were making from their recordings, or new music folks were making from their recordings, those were also going away, because recordings shifted from a profit-making venture to basically just a marketing tool. Nowadays, we invest in recording not to make money, we invest in recording to get our names out there so that we can actually say, this is who we are. You have to present a complete picture of yourself as a visual, as an audio professional, or as a performing professional. You have to show videos, you have to show recordings, you have to have full bios and photos and everything. Everything you have to do, you have to adapt to this world, which is more information all the time, more, more, more. That was starting 25 years ago, for sure.
And your wardrobe changed.
No, wardrobe absolutely changed. Well, we started, the very first concert choice we ever made for wardrobe was the four of us in flight suits. We had blue flight suits. I think we bought them at a military store, and then we wore Fluvog shoes. I still wear Fluvog shoes to this day. But we all had matching outfits as if we were Devo or something. Nowadays, it's relatively informal. We dress our personalities, truly. Kip is MacGyver. He's buttoned down always in a very respectful but never too formal way. So he'll have the practical outfit on and sort of muted colors. That's kind of his thing. Corey is a college dude still. He's got that college spirit, and so he's wearing the Oxfords and the jeans. And for me, I'm always the wild card. I always was. Sometimes I will wear crazy colors and everybody yells at me. I have some sequin pants from a tour we did 15 years ago. Nobody lets me wear those anymore. But yes, the wardrobe has shifted. If we have to wear the basic blacks for something in a more reverent context, we absolutely will. We can do that. But it's more about the self-expression of the four members and what we feel comfortable in. That's where we put our wardrobe energy.
So you moved away from a lot of traditional things with string quartet. The way you set up your stage, it's not set up like a regular string quartet either.
The three upper strings do not sit typically. We normally stand, and our configuration is different from the standard quartet configuration in that I am the violist and Dorothy's the cellist, and we are on the outside. So Dorothy is stage left, house right. I am stage right, house left. So I'm in effect at the first violin position, which means nothing. But the violins, Kip and Corey, are in the middle. And we came to that years ago, partially to throw the convention on its ear, but also because that put the violins right next to each other where they could battle it out. And we loved having the idea of the violins just center stage, just taking it on and just bashing each other if they need to, or just being lovingly supportive of each other when they're doing their work. As to further stage setup, yes, sometimes we will have additional instruments. Sometimes Kip will bring on a mandolin, or we will bring on percussion. Melodicas are fun. Sometimes a kazoo, who knows? Extra percussion for sure. And to our music stands and that sort of situation, we don't use paper music. A lot of times we play from memory, but if we need to use music, we're using tablets or iPads. And in doing that work, we're using these little clips that attach to microphone stands. So this is something we actually have to get across to presenters when we go to a new space, that we need 4 micro stands, but not for microphones. We need them for our iPad clips so that we can put our tablets on our stands.
I'm getting that you manage yourselves. So you must have done some kind of study or research into how to market yourselves and how to get to where you've had this success.
I'm going to say right now, Corey is a big proponent of all sorts of business courses. He's taking Harvard Business School classes, and he's a deep thinker in those directions, and he's advising us in extraordinary ways around how to keep current, how to watch for trends and leap on them in a relevant and organic way, i.e. how do we build our presence on YouTube? How do we keep supporting the eventual digitization of our industry? How do we connect with new collaborators and find concert programming that is actually going to sell? And in the beginning, I was in heaven because our first roughly year of existence, we took meetings almost as much as we rehearsed. We were looking to build something that inspired us, and we had a mentor, a brilliant fellow named Gideon Shine, who guided us through these meetings and talked to us about what we wanted, our hopes and dreams, and how to realize those dreams. The concrete result of that was that we founded a not-for-profit, and that particular step opened up worlds for us. It is Ethel's Foundation for the Arts, and it has become the backbone of all of our operation. It has afforded us the ability to apply for support. We can apply for grants in support of those programs. We we can connect with New York-based or state-based arts organizations or community service organizations that exist to give legitimacy and a sense of purpose to local work or to state-based work. Have the support of New York State and New York City arts organizations and cultural organizations is a stamp of approval that allows other funders support our works. Of course, we have built a board, which is just an amazing bunch of people. We have software designers, we have architects, we have lawyers, we have artists, visual artists, we have actors, we have musicians, we have reporters and educators. It's just an exceptional bunch of great, great people.
You said that Ethel is really committed to the community, that you've done a lot of things with schools and universities. Let's hear about some of those projects.
Originally, actually, Ethel was deeply involved with the cleanup and recovery at 9/11, at St. Paul's Chapel after the attacks of 9/11. St. Paul's Chapel was known as the Miracle Church, and we were there for many, many months. Doing that work. So between schools, colleges especially, and the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and with luck, an outdoor concert on the High Line this summer. This is all community building. The High Line, in case your listeners aren't familiar with it, it's a former railway that ran through New York City. It was an industrial railway that has now been turned into a park. It is absolutely awesome and super cool, and we are in discussions now to do a performance on the High Line this summer. So lots of different outreach type things.
So wait, let's circle back a little bit and talk a little bit more about the cleanup of 9/11. That sounds really interesting.
I was the musician volunteer coordinator at St. Paul's Chapel, which was the focal point of the cleanup of and the relief effort at Ground Zero from 9/11 until June after 9/11. And so three times a day, 7 days a week, we presented music at St. Paul's Chapel in support of the relief workers. As a musician, that was what I could do. That was the work that I could offer that could support. So we had iron workers, we had police officers, we had firefighters, we had healthcare workers, we had exhausted people coming in from the pile looking for respite, looking for calm, for peace, for meditation. And three times a day, we would offer them music in support of that mission. They would come there for food. They would come there for chiropractic work, for podiatry care. And then they got a little dose of Bach or folk guitar or Judy Collins or the Vienna Boys Choir or the pop band Dishwalla or my alma mater, Walnut Hill Chamber Music. So it was a beautiful thing that we got to do there. And then Ethel came and played several times at St. Paul's Chapel. And our work, Ethel's work there, was central to my own expression of grief and then turning that grief into action, doing something with it. You know, this is what I can do as a musician. So I'm gonna do it because that's all I can do. I just play the fiddle and I put people together to play. So that's what we did.
I know you did something at the Grand Canyon, and I was wondering, did you do something with the music of Native Americans?
For 10 years, Ethel was in residence at the Grand Canyon Music Festival's Native American Composers Apprenticeship Project, or program. But this particular work is so very close to my heart. What we did was we would follow in the footsteps of first composer Jared Impichacha Tate, and then composer Raven Chacon, and then composer Michael Begay. We would follow in their footsteps and perform in workshop for the composers, young high school composers of string quartets. These high school composers were from Navajo and Hopi nations. And we would travel all around Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, on Navajo and Hopi nations, and work with these young Native American students, working on their music and showing them, okay, this is great. You did this thing here. I've loved this little looping thing that you've got here. Can I do three more bars of it because I feel like there's this thing here? Or perhaps you gave me this technique I don't totally understand. Or did you really mean an F sharp there? It seems like it might be an F natural. Or, hey, I love this section. You should repeat it. It's the exact same stuff any musician would do with a young composer, except we got to do it with Native American high schoolers. And then what we would do is we would take music from one school and play it in another school. So we got to play Navajo students' music in a Hopi high school, and Hopi high school students in a Navajo high school. And then at the end of a week and a half, 10 days or so, of driving all around Navajo Nation and Hopi Nation, we would take the music to Grand Canyon, where we would play a concert celebrating all this music. And these concerts, we had 20, 30 pieces of music. So these were long concerts, and all the students and their parents would come, and they would have a camp out, and they would bus in. And it was just the most joy-filled, extraordinary program, and truly an absolute highlight of my life. It kind of makes me cry to think of it. It's just so beautiful. We made lifelong friends. We miss it terribly. It was just the most beautiful and life-affirming way to spend your time. We actually are returning to Navajo Nation. Ethel is returning to Navajo Nation in about 2 weeks. We're going to work with a young punk group called Sihasin. They are a sister and brother team. They are social activists, punk, as I said, community-oriented, change-oriented, incredible energy, fantastic songwriting, powerful lyrics. And Ethel's going to be collaborating with them, shooting some video. We're looking to build with them. And we'll be in Flagstaff, Arizona for about a week in early June to build with them and step into a new space with them.
Let's hear some stories from the road. You toured with Joe Jackson, Todd Rundgren.
Ethel has built several touring programs with lots of collaborators, and some of the great, great highlights of that touring world and building shows world with collaborators. One that really just stands out as a shining example was our tour in the early 2000s with Joe Jackson and Todd Rundgren. Two brilliant singer-songwriters, legendary. We did a show with them in New York City, then we did another show with them in New York City, Joe's Pub, and then Central Park, the Delacorte Theater. And then we were invited on tour. So what we did was we opened the shows for Joe and Todd, and then we backed them. We ended up on the Conan O'Brien show. We played Rome. We played Paris. We played Cleveland. It was just awesome. And we made lifelong friends and fans from that tour. Joe and Todd opened worlds to us, and they've remained very dear friends. We toured again with Todd a few years later in a show, a 70s program, a program celebrating the 70s. And Joe and Todd was actually on our Balcony Bar From Home series. Kip did a brilliant video. He wrote an arrangement and did a brilliant video of us all playing with Todd. It's I Saw the Light. It's a classic Todd tune, and the video is hilarious, and I cannot recommend it highly enough. It's so funny and cute and awesome. So that's Joe and Todd. We had a beautiful touring season with Khaki King, beloved guitarist and extraordinary artist. Oh my Lord, is she brilliant. She's folky, rock, urban, just great songwriting. Oh my Lord, is Khaki brilliant, and we love her dearly. We toured with her for a while. We've done several albums with her. We have one of our most cherished relationships is with Native American flutist, storyteller, and poet, and farmer and grandfather, Robert Mirabal. Robert is from Taos, Pueblo. We spent many years touring with him. We met him for our program called Truck Stop, which was at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. And that grew from our collaborative endeavors. That what we were looking to do was was build relationships and celebrate relationships and bring people together around shared works of art. And so that brought us to Taos Pueblo to connect with Robert. It brought us to Hawaii to work with guitarist Jeff Peterson. It brought us to San Antonio to work with Tejano Conjunto artist Eva Ibarra. And to Lexington, Hyden, Kentucky to work with bluegrass legend Dean Osborne. We brought them all to Brooklyn. Jeff's slack key guitar tying us all together as we explored Taos lore and Tejano Conjunto, beautiful storytelling and heartbreaking love stories and bluegrass, high lonesome sound. And it was just an exceptionally fun, super cool, groovy time. Then we've built these multimedia programs, these touring programs, Documerica, which is a feature of the EPA project, the same name from the 70s. And it's really an overview of the nation, a visual overview of the nation, the state of the nation, the people, the environment, from the 70s. And we wrote original music for that. And we commissioned four deeply moving pieces from composers Ulysses Owens Jr. I had mentioned him before, drummer, jazz artist extraordinaire, Minnesota-based, meditative, deeply serene, yet percussion-driven Mary Ellen Childs composer. She is just such a loving presence in her music. The celebrated Native American composer from, actually he says American Indian composer from Chickasaw Nation, Jared Impichacha Tate. We knew him from Grand Canyon. And then rounding it out, James Kimo Williams. And Kimo is a Vietnam vet and activist, and he's all about bringing the Vietnamese veterans community together with the American veterans community. It's very, very powerful stuff. So four American voices, and we added to that our own. And then we have Circus Wandering City, which was fully music. Music written fully by totally by Ethel, plus multimedia images and interviews from the Ringling Museum in Sarasota. So this is the story of the American circus. That's a touring program that we hope to bring out. It wasn't able to go during pandemic, so we're looking hopefully to bring that forward in the near future. There's an exceptional album that we're very proud of that accompanies that we'll release hopefully in conjunction with the tour. On my personal artistic endeavors, one really fun thing, this is just a crack up for me. Just after I met you, Paula, I went on the road in 1994 with the Roger Daltrey Band. I talked my way into becoming the fiddle soloist for the famous song Bob O'Reilly, and then I was associate conductor, so I was training orchestras for the concerts as Roger Daltrey was touring the music of The Who throughout the summer of 1994. I thought I was a rock star for a minute, and then the tour closed, and I came home to once again start playing weddings. And a few years later, the fella who did the orchestrations for the Who tour said, "Hey, would you like a Broadway show?" And I said, "Yes, please." And so he wrote the book to The Lion King for me, for violin, viola, double. And so for 16 and a half years, I played The Lion King. Just at that time, just around then, is when Ethel was starting. But I heard nothing from The Who or Roger Daltrey for several years, until about 3 years ago, Roger came together again on the road, and they started touring shows again, and I was invited to come play in the viola section for Roger and Pete and The Who. Zach Starkey, Ringo's son, was playing with them. He was on the tour with us again in 94. So we played with them in Jones Beach in New York and at Madison Square Garden. And I'm doing it again in 2 days. I'm going to play Madison Square Garden with Roger and Pete. It's hilarious because I used to be the star fiddle player. Now there is a young woman who is just, there's a star cellist. Yeah, there's a cello player and a young violinist. They're both young cello player and young violin player. They're both knocking it out of the park. And I just love the poetry of it. I'm now in the viola section, and it's really just hilarious to me and wonderful to reconnect with old friends. And these two young people are just doing amazing work and making Roger and Pete very happy, which is great.
So when we look at where you've ended up or all the things that you've done, is this what you planned or were you surprised?
This is not what I envisioned at all, but I'm not surprised. I wanted to be an actor. And the thing that, it's not surprising, but it's fascinating and kind of cool, is this roundabout path that I took from stepping away from my education. I was going into a doctoral program at Juilliard, and instead I decided to go run away with the WHO. That's the definition of disappointing your parents. Yes, my father was so upset. I went from Juilliard to the Rock Tour to the Broadway to building Ethel to having an institution, being an artistic director of an institution that now is in residence at one of the premier arts institutions on the planet, is in residence at one of the most inspired and forward-thinking and brilliant liberal arts institutions in Denison University, where we are in residence. I got my doctorate finally at Denison because they gave us honorary degrees, and my mom came and she was so proud. And now we do multimedia shows where I can sing, I can dance, I can actually act. We act in our circus program. We are actors on stage. We do film work. We do video work where we are fully expressed as complete artists, not just performers on our fiddles. We all write music. I write so much music. I have this outlet for expression. I did always think of myself as a composer, but I wasn't brought into that place through my formative years. It wasn't an option that was even considered. It just wasn't on the table for me, but now it's part of my life. We've got another project coming up. Okay, we're going to write music, and what a great gift that is. So I would say, again, I'm not surprised because I've seen where this was going once it started, but I'm getting to where I wanted to be, but in a completely roundabout, circuitous way that didn't necessarily make a lot of sense as it was happening, but now it's making a boatload of sense.
So of all your teachers, you went to Juilliard, you studied viola, who would you say influenced you in such a way that you found this success that you say was so circuitous? How did you get there? Who was it who really changed your life?
One of my great secrets to success and it's absolutely attitude. And that came most firmly from one of my mentors, Benjamin Zander. Benjamin Zander is a well-loved and slightly controversial figure, quite controversial figure in the Boston area. He's an extraordinary educator of young people. And he started at Walnut Hill School for the Arts when I started at Walnut Hill School for the Arts. And there was I think it was Monday masterclass that we had every week with him. We would have high tea and play for each other. And Ben would dance around the room and sing and just give us the world. And the big word with Ben was possibility. And that's what Ben gave me from the start. When we started the program with Ben, every single year, he would give us an A. He was our teacher. He would give us an A at the beginning of the year.
Like a grade.
A grade. And then our job through the year was to earn that A, to live into that A. And that was the great gift that Ben gave me. So I guess from that point forward at Walnut Hill, at NEC Prep, I was living into an A always, and there was always possibility. So if I'm playing Roger Daltrey's 50th birthday party at Carnegie Hall as the principal violist in the Juilliard Orchestra, there's a possibility I could be working with Roger again. So I'm going to go talk to Michael Kamen, the conductor and arranger of this stuff, and say, hey, Michael, I want your life. I want to work with these guys. How do I do it? 2 weeks later, possibility brought me the opportunity, and I was booked to be on the road with The Who. Well, with Roger, doing the music of The Who. Possibility brought me the audacity to think that we could start some new group that was playing crazy new music that nobody really thought had a chance. We didn't even name ourselves a string quartet, giving ourselves yet another kick in the shins. I remember Joe Jackson, our good friend, after we recorded with him for the first time, he got on the radio and he said, Ethel, great group, terrible name. Just a fabulous, fabulous thing. And through all of that, we had possibility. We had possibility that we could connect, we could share, we could celebrate community, we could bring new music to new ears. even as we have built new programs that on paper seem completely insane. Multimedia show celebrating the history of and power of the American circus. We brought it to life. We brought it to the Ringling Museum in Sarasota. We brought it to Brooklyn, to the Brooklyn Academy of Music. We're going to bring it on the road again. It is such an inspired way to live in possibility. And Ben brought me that.
So we have the Ben Zander connection too. I guess everybody in Boston knew Ben and the Ben Harmonic. Everybody had to play in the Ben Harmonic. And he really was inspiring in his way, you know, his eccentric way. So we have a lot in common. We've got a lot of things we're talking about here. I want to get back to what we first started with, Sarasota, the traveling city. How did you get started on that? It sounds really exciting.
We were approached by the presenter and producer of the Historic Oslo Theater, Dwight Curry was his name, and he said, "Hi, we'd love you to do what you did with Documerica, but with our collection." And if you don't know about it, the Circus Museum on the Ringling campus, the Ringling Museum in Sarasota, is the most fun-filled, awesome, inspiring circus display of history and costume and diorama. It's just, and film is an amazing collection. And so we got a chance to play with this collection and build a multimedia show. We wrote all the music for it. We brought in an extraordinary team of collaborators and designers, and we celebrated this collection and these stories and these interviews that Dwight did with historical gems, these amazing circus performers who are all located in Sarasota, because Sarasota is a big circus town. There were these interviews and all these photos and this music, and we were fully costumed, and Kip and Corey have a sword fight with their bows, and oh my lord, is it a fun romp. It's just a little over an hour. It's a fully staged multimedia immersion, and it was a big hit in Sarasota, and then we brought it to Brooklyn, also a big hit, and right now we're figuring out how to bring it on the road. The music is some of the best music I think Ethel has ever brought forward. We've got the introspective from Dorothy's got a beautiful piece called Pyramid that we all play together on her cello. The four of us on Dorothy's cello. We've got a piece of Corey's called On the Edge, which is about the Great Circus Fire in Connecticut in the 40s. And after that, more introspection, a piece of mine called Three Mirrors, which was originally designed to be a solo work for me, but then felt much better for the four of us. And that's, so we have the pain of the fire and then the release of introspection and recovery. Kip brought a brilliant jazz solo called Red Noseology, which features him and all of his flashy madness. We've got, again, Corey's Seat 47C, just beautiful impressionist nod to Debussy with a little hint of Elgar. We all wrote solos for the show. Dorothy wrote an amazing popper-esque cello suite for herself. And Dorothy, the whole show, is strapped into a harness. She never sits. She's got this harness that she's wearing the whole way through. And she's playing all this madly difficult music. Kip with the jazz fireworks. Corey does a clowning bit in the beginning. The whole thing's available on our YouTube channel, which is Ethel Central. That was a recording of the show, so folks can check it out and tell your local presenter you want to see it, and we'd love to come play it for you.
So here we are, 25 years. Ethel is asked for by name. It might be a household word someday. How does success sit with you? Any words of advice for anyone else following these footsteps?
To the question of people asking for us by name, it is true. It's kind of funky. We may have become a bit of a genre. that's a real surprise and a kick in the pants and kind of awesome that somebody may now say, "I'd like something sort of in an Ethel style." You know, as a string player, you go into a studio recording sometimes and they'll say, "You know, I need like an Eleanor Rigby type sound in a rock session or something." So you know how to bring that. It's the short strokes and the beautiful long flowing viola line. That's a sound somebody can reference. Or somebody back in the day and still today was referencing the Kronos as a color, as a spirit, as an ideal, as a polish, as a presentation technology. For us, there's a grit, there's an informality, there's even a silliness, and certainly a deeply moving and heartfelt connection that has become a genre. And I see this as young people are coming up and they're playing our music and they're looking at our historic recordings and seeing what they can glean from the approach to the work. We do have basic approaches to our sound that are just natural to the ethyl expression. One being, we don't use much vibrato. Vibrato is truly an ornamentation for us now. There were moments in, you know, we're playing the mission. Of course, we're going to be deeply vibrating in the tuneful sections. But the end of the tune, the end of the piece, we have a completely pure sound at the end. Kip's vocal, pure non-vibrato. Dorothy, Corey and me, with our strings supporting Kip at the end. Long crescendo, long note to the end that rings out, non-vibrato, sends it out into the universe with a pure sound. We will use the effects of the string playing extended techniques whenever we can. We're going to be super on the bridge. We're going to be super tosto. We're going to do crazy pizzicatos. We're going to tap the instruments, slam the instruments. We're going to sing. We're going to dance. We will use scratchando. You name it, we are going to use whatever tools we have at our fingertips or vocal cords to bring an ethyl spirit, an ethyl fun, an ethyl dance to the work. And yes, it has become a genre. I know this especially as I'm out there playing my work. I'm actually looking back at it and saying the journey I've come on, and I see, oh, when I'm playing with other people now, oh, this is how other people play, and this is how I play with Ethel, and isn't it neat that I can step to these two places? And it's an awesome journey. Honestly, it's something I'm pleased. I'm happy. Not a surprise, but I've come around to where I need to be, and it's kind of cool.
Check out Ethyl Central on YouTube or ethylcentral.org to hear more of the Ethyl Quartet. And that's it for today. Thanks for listening. Thanks for sharing. Thanks for supporting live music. See you next time.